Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. As Jeff said, I'm Jeff Farber, CEO of the Caret Foundation, member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors, and your chair for today. Our presentation by Ambassador John Bolton is part of the Toby Philanthropies American Values series. After serving as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, at the end of 2006, John Bolton returned to his old stomping grounds at the American Enterprise Institute, where he had been senior vice president before joining the George W. Bush administration in 2001. Since coming back to AEI, Mr. Bolton has continued to advocate the same set of policies he vigorously championed. First, as the Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security Affairs, and later as U.S. Ambassador to the UN. Mr. Bolton has been a key Republican Party figure since the early 1980s when he was asked to serve in the Reagan administration. He gained entry into the Reagan team through strong support from Senator Jesse Helms. Years later, Senator Helms would describe him, saying, "John Bolton is the kind of man with whom I would want to stand at Armageddon." Brash, unabashed, and confident, Bolton's foray into the administration of George W. Bush began with the Florida vote recount during the 2000 presidential election. Perhaps Mr. Bolton's most memorable moment came after the U.S. Supreme Court ordered a halt to the recount. Mr. Bolton strode into the Tallahassee Library, where the count was still going on, and declared, "I'm with the Bush-Cheney team, and I'm here to stop the count." After that, when Vice President-elect Dick Cheney was asked what position Mr. Bolton should get, he deadpanned, "Anything he wants." The job he got, as we now know, was U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. As to why he was selected for that position, President Bush had a characteristically no-nonsense reply. "Because," President Bush said, "he can get the job done." Ladies and gentlemen, it's my honor to introduce today's distinguished speaker, Ambassador John Bolton.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the introduction. And it's a great pleasure to be here in San Francisco at the Commonwealth Club. I've tried to get here several times before, and circumstances have required me to cancel out, sometimes at the last minute. Last year, there was an inconvenient war in the Middle East that prevented me from coming. But I am glad for this opportunity to be here, and I appreciate all of you coming out on such a wonderful day. I wanted to talk in my opening remarks about the key threats that the United States faces in the world today, and then obviously I'll be pleased to answer any questions on any subject you're interested in the second half. We have next year what I think is going to be a very consequential presidential election. And obviously, it's entirely appropriate and typical for domestic issues and a wide variety of policy matters to be debated. But I think that we should be actually spending a lot more of our time worried about international security questions than I'm afraid the election is shaping up to discuss, because these are some of the issues that are going to affect America over a long period of time. And while it's true that our current debate on foreign policy is dominated by Iraq, and in fact there are some politicians and political forces that would like nothing better than to talk about Iraq incessantly 24 hours a day, history will record that the threats that we do face from the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, nuclear, chemical, and biological, and the ballistic missile systems that can deliver them are really going to be much more important for the future security of the United States and its friends and allies than what happens in Iraq. We are at a perhaps unique moment in history where the United States faces no serious military threat. There's no country or combination of countries in the world that we need to worry about today, unlike most of the 20th century. Now, this may be a very brief moment with the rise of China and India and the resurgence of Russia, but in the interim, what we face is not a national threat so much as it is a threat from a class of weapons. And it's one of the reasons that because of the terrible destructive power of this class of weapons, that the Bush administration undertook a revision of the national security strategy in the early days of the administration to focus on what is really the most effective and perhaps the only effective way of preventing the use of weapons of mass destruction, and that's to stop them from coming into the hands of rogue states and terrorist groups to begin with. We don't face the kind of threat that we did during Cold War days of a nuclear exchange with the Soviet Union that would effectively end civilization in both countries. We face the threat of a small handful of nuclear devices or other weapons of mass destruction in the hands of rogue states and terrorists. This is the classic description of an asymmetric threat. But it's not the kind of threat that is possible to deter in the classic sense that we understood during the Cold War. Regimes run by people like Kim Jong-il or religious regimes like the one in Iran have fundamentally different values that are not subject to worrying about the threat of retaliation, and therefore deterrence is not as likely to work. The people who carried out September the 11th were not only prepared to die in the course of their attacks, they wanted to die. Those are not people you can deter by the threat of retaliation. And even though there's no doubt that if we were attacked with weapons of mass destruction and did retaliate, that the retaliation would be swift and decisive, it's not sufficient, I think, for the people who died in the original attack. It's not enough to say, well, it was only San Francisco. So that while the threat is not as cosmic as it was during the Cold War, death by weapon of mass destruction is not a threat that the United States should allow itself to have to live under. And that's why when we look at regimes like Iran and North Korea, taking the steps to make sure that they don't acquire the capability in the first place or that if they do, we find a way to roll it back as soon as possible are so important. I want to talk particularly about Iran and North Korea. This is a clear example that when President Bush referred to an axis of evil, he wasn't simply indulging in a metaphor. These two states have cooperated closely over the years in their ballistic missile program. They both use the same Soviet-era Scud technology. Even when North Korea from the late 1990s was engaged in a moratorium on launch testing from the Korean Peninsula. In Iran, they were launching succeedingly more sophisticated versions of Scud prototypes and sharing that information with North Korea. We don't know whether North Korea and Iran have cooperated extensively on their nuclear programs, but we do know that both of them were customers of the AQCON proliferation network, the network established by the father of the Pakistani nuclear weapon who took his entrepreneurial skills into the proliferation market and sold critical nuclear technology to Iran, North Korea, and Libya that we know of for sure and perhaps other countries as well. So given that North Korea and Iran both depended at least in part, although I think only in part, on AQCON, it wouldn't be surprising if there were cooperation in the nuclear field as well. North Korea, just to take a brief picture of the regime, North Korea is a prison camp. Its 17 to 18 million citizens are as deprived and oppressed as any people on this planet over the last century. During the past several decades, the average height and weight of the North Korean citizen has declined. Think about that. Their average height and weight is going down, even as Kim Jong-il's regime aggressively pursues all the forms of weapons of mass destruction and ballistic missiles. North Korea is not only a prison camp, it's a criminal regime. It will do anything to acquire hard currency. It's the world's largest proliferator of ballistic missile technology, largely into the sensitive region of the Middle East. North Korea counterfeits American, probably other money, in a way so sophisticated that the people at the Treasury Department who deal with this issue call their notes super bills because they're so sophisticated, meaning we don't really have a clear idea how much of our money they've counterfeited. North Korea sells illegal narcotics through their diplomatic pouches. And until Japan cracked down in the past few years, North Korea controlled most illicit gambling activities in Japan. So this is a regime devoted to its own survival and devoted to acquiring the weapons that can help keep it in power. It is happy and has been happy to negotiate about giving up its nuclear weapons capability. In fact, it's even happy to commit to give up its nuclear weapons capability in exchange for tangible economic and political benefits. It's done it several times. It's done it again most recently in February. It's very pleased to make these commitments, to receive the benefits, and then to violate the agreement. In 1994, it negotiated what was called the agreed framework with the Clinton administration, where it agreed to freeze the Yongbyon reactor. Does this sound familiar? To freeze the Yongbyon reactor and to give up its pursuit of nuclear weapons. Within a very short time after signing that agreement that would have frozen its plutonium route to nuclear weapons, it began a procurement program for an industrial-sized uranium enrichment capability, the second, the alternative route to nuclear weapons. So signing agreements to give up the nuclear weapons capability are second nature to the North Koreans, and they've done it again. And they have achieved, as they did in 1994, commitments by South Korea and the United States to provide them with tangible economic and political benefits. Now, here's the real question. Do you believe that North Korea will ever voluntarily give up its nuclear weapons capability? If you believe the answer to that question is yes, then, of course, it makes perfectly good sense to negotiate with North Korea in an effort to find a way to induce them to do it. On the other hand, if you think they believe that giving up their nuclear weapons is the equivalent of committing regime suicide, as I do, then their conclusion has to be they will not voluntarily give up nuclear weapons. And I think that's exactly the circumstance we're in now. They have once again made the promise. They have taken some preliminary steps. And just true to the playbook that's in Kim Jong-il's desk in Pyongyang, South Korea and the United States and China have increased their levels of assistance, thus helping to get Kim Jong-il out of the corner that he put himself in last year in October by testing a nuclear device. I think that the current strategy in North Korea is to play for time, hoping that in 18 months after our election they'll have a president in Washington who's even more willing to negotiate with them, more willing to compromise, more willing to prop up the regime running this prison camp in North Korea. In fact, the past 4 to 5 years of diplomacy, unfortunately, have given North Korea what proliferators need more than anything else, the one asset they can't purchase, and that's time. Time is on the side of the proliferators. Time is not on the side of the United States and those who stand against proliferation. Time gives the proliferator what he needs to overcome scientific and technological difficulties in his program, time to reinforce his position in leadership, time to increase the threat level to nearby countries and to the world as a whole. Now, one would think that China would have a vested interest in making sure that North Korea doesn't acquire nuclear weapons. And I do take China at its word when it says it doesn't want North Korea with nuclear weapons, because that could induce at some point Japan and perhaps other countries to acquire their own nuclear weapons capability. And from China's point of view, proliferation and the consequent instability in Northeast Asia would have to be detrimental to its long-range economic development goals because of the political instability that the proliferation would create. But China, and so in that sense, the goals of China and the United States are congruent. Where there is a difference is that China fears that if it applies too much pressure to the North Korean regime to accomplish that objective, that the regime is sufficiently fragile that it could collapse. China supplies 80% to 90% of North Korea's energy. China supplies a huge amount of food assistance to North Korea, not out of humanitarian motivations, but basically they'd rather feed the North Koreans on their side of the Yalu River than on the Chinese side of the Yalu River. And they see that if they were able to cut off these supplies in an effort to pressure Kim Jong-il to give up his quest for nuclear weapons, the result might be the collapse of the regime itself. And if there were a collapse in North Korea, there's no doubt that it would be filled by the United States and South Korea in an effort to stabilize the situation, and that would lead to the reunification of the Korean Peninsula, with which the Chinese don't want. They like having a buffer state in North Korea. They fear in a reunited Korea that there would be American troops on the Yalu River. They've seen that movie before. They didn't like it the first time they saw it. They don't like it any better now. So the result is that the Chinese don't do much to pressure North Korea, much of what they need to do to actually bring a change. And I think, therefore, that we face an increasingly unpleasant set of options on how to deal with North Korea if we're truly serious about bringing their nuclear capability to an end. I think that the objective of the United States should be what it has been since 1945, the reunification of the Korean Peninsula, the elimination of Kim Jong-il's regime, the cleaning up of that prison camp, and giving the opportunity for the Korean people to lead a decent and peaceful life. That is the only thing that's going to solve the nuclear problem in North Korea, that or the even more unattractive option of the use of force, because the dynamic is such that as long as North Korea has this nuclear capability, it remains a threat, not just in Northeast Asia, but because it is a government that will do anything for hard currency, it's entirely conceivable it could sell a nuclear device to Al-Qaeda or anybody else with the right price, and therefore would constitute a threat on a global basis, no matter what the state of development of its missile program is. And it really is the risk of terrorists acquiring weapons of mass destruction as much as the rogue states themselves that should fill us with concern. And that's why Iran's steady progress toward a nuclear weapons capability is as much or perhaps even more troubling than North Korea. Iran has been pursuing nuclear weapons in a clandestine fashion for close to 20 years. It has, although it's a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, where it's committed to be a non-nuclear weapon state, for most of this 20-year period, it has lied to the International Atomic Energy Agency. It's concealed information from the IAEA. It's withheld data, distorted data. It's even gone so far as to bulldoze buildings and excavate hundreds and hundreds of cubic yards of dirt in order to hide traces of radioactivity from IAEA inspectors. Iran says that its nuclear program is entirely peaceful, that it's just for civil nuclear power purposes, because they say, after all, we're running out of oil and natural gas in Iran. Several years ago, when I was in government, I asked the Energy Department to look into this Iranian claim that they were about to run out. And the Department of Energy experts studied the evidence they had and came back with the conclusion that indeed Iran was running out of oil and natural gas. At the current rate of domestic consumption and export, Iran will run out of natural gas in about 350 or 400 years. So, of course, it makes perfectly good sense to plan against that contingency. The fact is, we know that the scope of Iran's activities across the entire nuclear fuel cycle is only explainable by the pursuit of nuclear weapons. We know this not simply because of intelligence. We know this now from data that's publicly available. Much of it has been published by the International Atomic Energy Agency. And I'll just give two quick examples. The IAEA came into the possession of documents that the Iranians had that show how you form uranium metal into hollow hemispheres, you know, like the hollow metal globes we all had as children. That is the way the joining of two hollow hemispheres of highly enriched uranium that you put together what our scientists euphemistically call the physics package of a nuclear weapon. Put two hollow hemispheres of enriched uranium together, surround it with high explosives, detonate the high explosives, the uranium compresses, it forms a critical mass, and you get a nuclear explosion. There is no peaceful use for fabricating uranium metal into hollow hemispheres, and unless you think the Iranians just have a high level of interest in abstract nuclear physics, that's a pretty compelling piece of evidence what they're up to. Secretary Powell, right before he left office as Secretary of State, described other information that we have about the way in which the Iranians are attempting to achieve a critical stage in the development of their nuclear weapons program to form the nuclear warhead in such a way that it can fit into a nose cone of the ballistic missile program that they're developing, so that you have a reentry vehicle that can carry the nuclear warhead, carry the payload to its target. Again, this has nothing whatever to do with civil nuclear power. Now, over the past several years, we have allowed our friends in Europe, Britain, France, and Germany, whom we call the EU3, to negotiate with Iran to attempt to see if there's a package of incentives, or carrots, as we call them at the State Department, that would induce Iran to give up nuclear weapons. And I can tell you, after nearly 4 years of activity, there's almost no carrot I can conceive of that the Europeans haven't tried to offer Iran, to give Iran, to give this government in Tehran the prospect of a new relationship with the United States. And with the exception of a couple of brief periods, the Iranians have consistently rebuffed the European efforts, saying that they had a right to this nuclear technology and they intended to pursue it. The Iranians have continued to ignore these efforts at negotiation. They have failed to comply with multiple resolutions of the IAEA Board of Governors, including one by an overwhelming majority about a year and a half ago, calling on them to suspend their uranium enrichment activity. That program was then referred to the Security Council, but whereby a nearly unanimous vote, the Security Council ordered Iran to suspend its uranium enrichment activity, an order which the Iranians ignored, resulting in two sanctions resolutions, much weaker than they should have been, I'm sorry to say, but with additional 60-day deadlines for Iran to suspend its uranium enrichment. Two more resolutions that Iran ignored. So with respect to Iran, we can ask the same question we ask of North Korea. Do you believe that Iran will voluntarily give up its pursuit of nuclear weapons? The Europeans have believed that, and for nearly 5 years they've tried to negotiate with Iran. And the practical answer that Iran has given is take a hike. And that's because in Iran's view of its place in the world, nuclear weapons are a trump card for it as well. Iran is under the current government, is aggressively pursuing a substantial increase in its authority in its region and beyond. It supplies weapons and financial assistance to radical groups inside Iraq. It's gone so far now as to begin supplying the Taliban in Afghanistan, once its sworn enemy, with weapons to attack the United States. Iran finances Hezbollah, the Shiite militia group in Lebanon, to the tune of around $100 million a year, perhaps more. Iran finances Hamas, which is now in control on the Gaza Strip, even though Hamas is essentially a Sunni Islamic party and the Iranians are Shiites. Secretary Rice has called Iran the world's central banker of terrorism. So if you look at this pattern of behavior, of support for terrorism, pursuit of nuclear weapons, this is the mark of a government that knows the direction it's moving. And indeed, its current president, Ahmadinejad, has said very clearly what some of his objectives are. He's called for Israel to be wiped off the map. You look back in history and you wonder sometimes when somebody gives you a signal what they're about to do and you ignore it, what does it take to look at people and say, you know, sometimes people actually say what they mean. When Hitler wrote Mein Kampf, people said, well, this is lunacy. This isn't going to happen. When he marched into the Rhineland in 1936, Britain and France weren't willing to do anything about it. They weren't willing to use force to push the German military back, just as today Britain and France and Germany are not willing to contemplate the use of force in Iran. In fact, this nearly 5 years of diplomacy, unsuccessful diplomacy, failed diplomacy, has put us in a very difficult position. As in the case of North Korea, our options are now limited. I think the only secure route to preventing Iran from getting nuclear weapons is to change the regime in Tehran. And this has been our historical experience as well. At a period when regimes undergo fundamental change, they have been we have been able to induce some of them to give up the pursuit of nuclear weapons. When the apartheid regime fell in South Africa and a truly democratic government took over, that new government decided it would give up the pursuit of nuclear weapons. When the Soviet Union collapsed, new governments in Ukraine, Kazakhstan, and Belarus returned Soviet nuclear weapons to the Russian Federation. And it's possible that a new government in Tehran would also conclude that they were better off not pursuing nuclear weapons rather than continuing to do so. I think regime change in Iran is feasible. There's enormous dissatisfaction in the country. Since 1979, the Islamic Revolution has grossly mismanaged the economy, and there's evidence of enormous economic dissatisfaction. The young people of Iran are educated and knowledgeable, and they can see that there's a different kind of life that they could lead free of the harsh Sharia rule of the current government. And there's a substantial ethnic dissatisfaction in Iran as well. So that the possibility of regime change, I think, is real. But regime change is difficult, it's complex, it could take a long time, and as Iran drives toward the day when it does have its own nuclear weapons capability, time is becoming very short. And that's why, as a last resort, and in a very unattractive fashion, the use of military force has to be an option for us as well. Would not involve the kind of ground forces that are engaged in Iraq today. It could be done, I think, by breaking the nuclear fuel cycle at several critical points via airstrikes. I don't recommend this alternative. I don't look forward to it. It is at best a last resort. But if the question is, do you prefer to have an Iran with nuclear weapons or to use military force to stop it, then I think it becomes an option that we have to consider. Because the Iran that we see today is increasing its influence, increasing its power, and so far there's no indication that it's prepared to slow down. Now, both Iran and North Korea have one other option. They can come to their senses and they can conclude that they'd be better off giving up the pursuit of nuclear weapons than continuing to go after them. Unlikely as it may seem, Muammar Gaddafi in Libya did reach this conclusion. After the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, he looked at the situation, and erroneously as it turned out, but decided perhaps he might be next. In connection with a number of other things we did that basically showed we knew that he was engaged with the AQCON proliferation network, Gaddafi came to the United Kingdom and the United States and, after some difficult negotiations, agreed to give up his nuclear weapons program. And he did it the right way. He didn't drag out negotiations the way North Korea and Iran have done, where we don't even have the beginnings of an agreement on what our verification mechanism for North Korea and Iran will be. Gaddafi opened up his facilities to the CIA and the SIS, who were able to go wherever they wanted to in Libya and verify what we thought we knew or didn't know about his nuclear program. And then, so great was his determination to prove to us that he was giving up the pursuit of nuclear weapons that Gaddafi allowed an American ship to come to Libya, where his nuclear program was boxed up and brought to the United States. The Libyan nuclear weapons program today lives in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And there's plenty of room next to it for the North Korean nuclear weapons program and the Iranian nuclear weapons program if they make that decision. But let me say, in the effort to stop these countries from getting nuclear weapons and the effort to stop other countries that are watching the Iran and North Korea experiences, I think we should try and have as many political allies as we can from Europe, elsewhere in the world. Certainly hope we can use the United Nations, but make no mistake about it. This proliferation will not be stopped by Brussels, will not be stopped by the UN. If there's anybody that's going to stop it, it's the United States of America. Thank you very much.
thanks to John Bolton, former United States Ambassador to the United Nations and Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, for his comments today. I'm Jeff Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and President of Northern California Public Broadcasting, KQED's parent company, and I will be conducting the question and answer portion of our program. And Ambassador Bolton, as you could see, we have a wide array of questions, and we'll begin. First of all, prior to your role at the UN, you were quite critical of the organization. You've been there and gone. How has that view changed, or has it stayed the same?
It hasn't changed at all.
What kind of changes would you believe would be most appropriate for the UN to succeed?
Well, I have come to the conclusion that efforts at marginal or incremental change at the UN are not going to work, so I'm now down to one change. The bulk of the UN system is financed by what are called assessed contributions. This is a system effectively of mandatory contributions where the UN budget is decided and then payment of these expenses is allocated on the member governments. The United States, under this formula of assessed contributions, pays 22% of the budget, 27% of peacekeeping. Just to give you an example of the disproportionate size of this contribution, the UN member that pays the smallest assessed contribution pays 0.001% of the budget. I once added up the total assessed contributions of the lowest 97 payers of assessed contributions. 97 because there are 192 member governments, 97 constitute an assembly in the a majority in the General Assembly where budget matters are decided. Let me just say, there's no veto in the General Assembly. We have a veto in the Security Council. We are in the food chain, one of 192 countries in the General Assembly. If you add the contributions together of the lowest 97 contributing countries, they amount to 0.232% of the UN budget, meaning that our 22% contribution is roughly 70 times greater than the aggregate contributions of the lowest 97 paying members. It's fun to spend other people's money, and basically people have fun spending ours. So I would take advantage of our experience with those components of the UN system that are funded by voluntary contributions, like the High Commissioner for Refugees, like the World Food Program, like many others, where I think the common experience in the United States is these are better run, more transparent, more efficient, more responsive to the donors. And we should shift from a system of assessed contributions to a system of voluntary contributions. This will be very difficult to implement politically. It involves the following radical thought. We should pay for what we want and get what we pay for. This is revolutionary in the UN, but I think that it's what the United States should seek to achieve. That way, if we think a program is well run, as for example in the case of the World Food Program, where we contribute nearly 50% of the food annually that the World Food Program distributes to humanitarian needs around the world, we'd do that. And if we didn't want to contribute anything, such as to the UN Human Rights Commission, we drop our contribution to zero. Well, the General Assembly is free to adopt whatever programs it wants, and all it has to do is find somebody to pay for them.
Why is the UN unable to be effective today, particularly in Darfur?
The UN, at best, is a reflection of the world as a whole. It has 192 member governments, and they have a lot of different interests and opinions. In fact, at the UN, every member government pursues its interest. Every member government pursues its interest. The only member government that's criticized for that is the United States. To take the question of Darfur specifically, the president feels emotionally and personally very strongly about the genocide that's been going on in Darfur. And during my tenure in New York, was constantly looking at ways to get a UN peacekeeping force into Darfur to try and relieve the African Union force that was there and to give some stability, protection, and assistance to the people of the Darfur region. But we were constantly blocked because the government of Sudan would not consent to the deployment of this force, and because its opposition was advocated in the Security Council by China, Russia, and Qatar. Why would these nations do this? China has a large and expanding energy demand. In fact, this is going to be a major element of their foreign policy well into the foreseeable future. They have interest in oil and gas licenses from the government in Khartoum, and they were willing to front for that government in the Security Council. Russia has its own interest in terms of sales of conventional weapons, and Qatar at that time was the, in effect, the de facto representative of the Arab League, and the government in Khartoum, a member of the Arab League, and essentially used that affiliation to help protect itself. So after nearly 2 years of effort, there's still no real UN peacekeeping force in Darfur. I'm not sure that one is ever going to be deployed that's effective. And it's a sad commentary that for some, this is an area where the U.S. has zero national interest. We're doing this because of our humanitarian concern for the suffering of the people of Darfur, and the Security Council can't act effectively on it.
As you look at the experience you had at the UN, what would you say your greatest success was, and what were the barriers to success?
Well, actually, I think the greatest success I had at the UN was not when I was ambassador, but in President Bush 41's administration, when I was at the State Department as Assistant Secretary for International Organization Affairs in 1991. After a lot of effort, we persuaded a substantial majority of the General Assembly to repeal the 1975 resolution that equated Zionism with racism. And I thought that was the right thing to do then. I still think it was probably the most significant thing I did in the UN over the course of my entire career there.
Let's turn to other parts of the world. We're seeing a different mindset, or at least different rhetoric, coming out of Russia today. Could you give us your assessment of what's happening with President Putin, where you think that may be heading us? And one person was concerned, would it possibly lead us toward another Cold War situation?
I think what's happening in Russia today is that there's a feeling of resurgent power because of the price of oil that has brought money into the Russian treasury in ways that even 5 or 6 years ago they couldn't contemplate. It's allowing them to recreate many of their military forces, but it's also led to a resurgence of what I can only call czarist attitudes to government, centralization of authority, control over the state's control over natural resources, a turning away from democratic processes, and a more aggressive external policy. I think that's made itself evident even to the Europeans because of their potential dependence on Russian petroleum from pipelines out of Russia into Europe. And I think also it's due to Russia's feeling of insecurity, which may well amount to a missed opportunity for the United States. Russia doesn't have the Warsaw Pact. Russia doesn't have the Soviet Empire. Its affiliation with Western security structures is minimal. It has itself experienced the actuality of Islamic terrorism in Chechnya and the school seizure in Beslan, even to the point of explosive devices in subways in Moscow. I still think that this is a situation that can be corrected if we could work with Russia, and I think although we're kind of backing into it, as we first offered the Russians when we got out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty of 1972, and we got out of it in 2001, we offered the Russians then cooperation on anti-ballistic missile research and development, and it may well be that President Putin's about to take that up. I hope that he does, because I think we do have a common interest, and I think this might be a way to help work again on integrating Russia more intensively into our security structures.
We've had a change in leadership in France. How do you foresee our moving forward to repair any issues that have cropped up during the Iraq situation, or to bring our other European allies closer together in the fight against terrorism?
Well, I think President Sarkozy comes to his office more inclined to be pro-American than his predecessor, not that that's hard to do. I think he could go a long way to repairing some of the damage by unleashing French prosecutorial authorities to go after people who benefited illicitly from the Oil for Food program. That would produce some surprising results, I think. But I think it's also important not to get too excited about this. In the negotiations of the revised European Treaty a few weeks ago, President Sarkozy was instrumental in striking from the main text of the document a reference to the benefits of economic competition. In fact, he is quoted as saying publicly, what has competition done for us? That's not encouraging if, if you're looking for a more open international economic system. That said, I still think on balance, this is a positive development. I think there's a broader question, though, about the divergence between Europe and the United States on a range of issues that I think is attributable to, in large part, to the fact that freed from the communist threat, many of the differences that existed for some time in European approaches to the world and American approaches to the world now have the luxury of coming to the surface. And we'll see, for example, what the new government of Prime Minister Brown in the United Kingdom does and what policies it pursues. So I think that even structures like the NATO alliance remain in question as Europe. This separation is not anything that the United States is choosing. This is what Europe is choosing. They're democratic governments. They can perform as they like. But I think it's very troubling for the long-term stability of transatlantic relations.
Since you touched on it, another question came up. What is your current assessment of NATO and its work around the world?
Well, I think NATO is a great treasure that was principally responsible through the policy of containment for collapsing communism. You know, one of the manifestations of the attitude in Europe that troubles me is you can today hear senior, responsible European statesmen say that the Cold War was ended in Europe because of the European Union. Now, I don't think there's anybody in the United States who thinks that, but a lot of them in Europe think that. And, you know, if they think the European Union's going to protect them from Islamic terrorism, they can have fun with that, too. I think that NATO has had a remarkable renaissance. It's in Afghanistan, not as well as performing as well as we would like because of restrictions placed on NATO troops by various NATO members. But a few years ago, people thought that the collapse of the Warsaw Pact would mean the end of NATO itself. I think we need to look at other missions for NATO out of area, out of Europe. There's really no military threat in Europe today. The threats are external, and I think we should be thinking of even more radical steps with NATO. Former Spanish Prime Minister José María Aznar has suggested, for example, that NATO's membership be expanded to include Japan, Australia, Israel. Not terribly close to the North Atlantic, but democracies with common values and interests for ours. I think that's something we should look at very seriously because I think that would help give NATO the global reach that would keep it viable for many years to come.
Let's move now. You mentioned it briefly in your discussion to China, and you talked a bit about the Chinese and their relationship to North Korea, but they're continuing to have a growing influence here in the U.S. through their holding of our debt, pouring a lot of money into the stock market and real estate. Excuse me. Are you worried about that at this point in time? And if so, what would you do to address it?
Well, I think it'd be advantageous for the United States for some of and for the international economic order as a whole, for some of the trillion-plus dollars of hard currency reserves that the Chinese have to work their way back into the international system. I recall several years ago when there was a very substantial increase in Japanese investment in the United States, buying Rockefeller Center and a lot of things like that, and within a few years, those investments had all gone down, and I see the first major Chinese investment in Blackstone went down since that's now below its initial public offering price. So, you know, just because you have a lot of money doesn't mean you're going to invest it well. The fact is we don't know And we can't predict clearly what the future of China is going to be. I think it would be a mistake to assume a straight line extrapolation of its economic growth or necessarily the stability and pacific policies of the regime as a whole. It's very unclear, for example, just how strong the central government's authority is over many of the regions of China, where decisions on all kinds of matters are being taken without consulting the central government. And we shouldn't forget that it was only a few decades ago that China was divided into competing provinces led by warlords. It's not necessary that the China you see today is the China you're going to see in 50 years. Moreover, it's not at all clear who is dominant in the central Chinese government in terms of decision-making authority on many critical issues. A few months ago, China proved that it had an anti-satellite capability when it shot down one of its own weather satellites. And since that time, people have asked the question, well, who authorized that? And there are multiple theories, but two, for example, one is that the People's Liberation Army decided to do it on their own and that the civilian government in Beijing wasn't responsible. And people tell us that's a good thing because it shows how reasonable the civilians are. I don't necessarily see it that way. I think when a military decides it's going to take actions like that, doesn't bother to ask its theoretical leadership what they think of it. That doesn't make me happy. The other possibility is that the civilian leadership knew and approved of the decision to do that. That makes me even less happy. So, you know, the idea that we see an inevitable peaceful evolution of a democratic China, I think would be wonderful if it were to happen. But I don't see it as inevitable. And I think the possibility of major discontinuities in China's course in the near future are much higher than people think, and that therefore it's very difficult to project out over the long term whether this development will continue to be peaceful or move in a democratic direction.
Should we be worried about China increasing its military strength and or the possibility they would gain weapons of mass destruction?
Well, they certainly have weapons of mass destruction now. They have a ballistic missile force. There's evidence that they're beginning to that they are, in fact, expanding their ballistic submarine force. They've had one ballistic missile submarine for some time, but they're now in the process of greatly expanding that. That obviously makes it much more difficult to track what their exact capabilities are. They've had enormous increases in the public budget for the military, and that's that alone is not necessarily indicative of how much they really are spending on their military. They have dramatically increase their overall naval construction and planning in an effort, I think, to project power well out into the Pacific Ocean, that is to say, well past Taiwan. They've stationed something like, in the past few years, 1,000 missiles within range of Taiwan, concentrated, if you look at the deployment, aimed at the island. If their naval power through submarines in the Taiwan Strait or a larger naval capability east of Taiwan would prevent us from carrying through on our commitment to defend Taiwan in the case of military attack. This is all very, very worrisome, and I don't think the Chinese have good explanations. I fear that what's happening is that the People's Liberation Army, which is what it applies to the Navy and the Air Force, are all part of the People's Liberation Army, is increasing its capabilities in a very troubling way.
I want to remind our audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker is John Bolton, former U.S. Ambassador of the United Nations, who is discussing American foreign policy and international security. Those who are looking, at least those in our audience today, who are looking at the current Bush administration's policies toward diplomacy, see it more as a shoot first, ask questions later, or a lack of diplomatic movement. Would you address how we're getting that impression in addition to where you see diplomacy really having an impact positively on the world situation and the U.S.'s role in it?
Well, I don't know where you're getting the impression, but it's a misimpression. I mean, the Bush administration has conducted an enormously successful range of diplomatic activity. We got out of the ABM treaty with Russia without incident. In May of 2002, we signed the Treaty of Moscow with Russia that will reduce operationally deployed strategic nuclear warheads by two-thirds for both countries over a 10-year period. Our policy on North Korea and Iran has been run essentially through multilateral vehicles, unsuccessfully, I might point out, but it's been run through multilateral vehicles. And in fact, diplomacy has been exercised in a broad variety of areas. The problem here, I think, is that there is a view, and it's common in Europe, and there are a lot of people in the United States who believe it as well, that diplomacy is the only answer. And in fact, it's not. But this is not a debate between groups of people who favor diplomacy on the one hand and the Bush administration that never favors diplomacy. The debate's really between two broad categories of people. One category believes that diplomacy in the resolution of international disputes, diplomacy should be used 99 and 44 one-hundredths percent of the time. And I include myself in that group. Versus a second group that says diplomacy should be used 100% of the time. And for that second group, diplomacy has ceased to be a technique and it's become an objective. And that's where their fatal mistake is.
Let's talk a little bit about security at home. One person in the audience wanted to know how you would secure our borders effectively.
In 1986, I was at the Justice Department in charge of legislative affairs and working for Ed Meese. And one of the things we did that year after 6 years of trying in the Reagan administration was pass legislation called the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986 because of the problem of illegal immigration. And IRCA, as it was known, had three principal elements. One, stronger enforcement along the border against illegal immigration. Two, a path to legalization for people who are already here illegally. And three, employer sanctions to prevent more people from coming. And we happily passed that in 1986. And if you can tell me the difference between 1985 and 2006 in terms of its effect on illegal immigration, I'd be happy to hear it. So in 2007, people are considering another immigration bill. They want stronger enforcement along the border. They want a path to legalization for people who are here, and they want tougher sanctions against the employment of illegal aliens. The fact is that the 86 bill failed, and even if this bill had been enacted, it would fail. America is a magnet because of its economic strength and its political freedom. And I, for one, am not that worried about it. Immigration reform I would like to see is to increase the possibility for legal immigration from many other countries and to abandon, as this bill did in part, but basically to get rid of quota systems that limit immigration from many other countries. This is the strongest aspect the United States has. You know, we have 300 million people in this country. India and China have over a billion. We've got a long way to go.
Ambassador Bolton, you do have some sway with the administration and having been a part of it. And another person wanted to know, how do we persuade the administration to change immigration so that more of the highly trained, highly skilled professionals that we need in this country are not barred from entry?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is another unfortunate aspect of our policy. A lot of it obviously has to do with 9/11, but it also has to do with attitudes that have grown up over a long period of time. I remember in 1989, when we were celebrating the anniversary of the Constitution, we had a joke at the Justice Department that at various times during that celebration, new citizens would be sworn in. And there's a line in the ceremony, almost like the line at the marriage vows, where the judge will say, if anybody objects to any of these people being sworn in, we'd like to hear it. We had a joke that representatives from the Immigration and Naturalization Service would be all over the place saying, we object, we object. It is cutting off our nose to spite our face to restrict the flow of people who want to come in, study at our universities, work for our companies, I'm a very strong believer that the strength of America is in persuading people that our way of life is the best, and the way you do that is by bringing them in. So I obviously don't want to make us a magnet in the sense of people who come and live off our generous welfare benefits and are susceptible to crime and whatnot. But by and large, the people who come in want to work, want to develop families, and so I'm on the squishy wing of the Republican Party on that subject.
Let's move on now to a perspective that essentially our position in Iraq and our activities in the Middle East really have put us in the anti-American and extremism situations we find ourselves today. Can you talk a bit about how our Middle East policy and our entry into Iraq has had an impact on a growing anti-Americanism from your vantage point, if that in fact is true? And second, are there any regrets related to the attack and the invasion on Iraq, given our military position today and its perceived weakness?
Well, first, I don't think that attitudes about America today are necessarily worse than they have been at other comparable points in history in recent years. During the Vietnam War, during the Reagan administration at the time of the deployment of intermediate-range nuclear forces in Europe and a variety of other circumstances, I've heard it all before. And, you know, it's if we conducted our foreign policy to get high public opinion ratings in foreign countries, we wouldn't have much of a foreign policy. It's not that I am unmindful of the negative consequence of that. I'd much rather have the United States regarded in a better light, but we've got to pursue the foreign policy that's in our interest. That's what the president's elected to do. And if it means we could do a better job at public diplomacy, I don't dispute that. I think that despite efforts in this and previous administrations, our public diplomacy internationally is wretched and could only get better. But again, our interests have to be the foundation on which we act and not whether people overseas think we're popular. With respect to Iraq, I think there are two analytical questions that you have to examine. First question is, were we right to overthrow Saddam Hussein? And I think the answer to that question remains unquestionably yes. Second question, how have we done since the overthrow? And the answer to that is, it's a mess. There are a lot of lessons we have learned, I think, from the past 4 years in Iraq, but I think the most important lesson is, however difficult the circumstances are there now, the way to address those issues is not to conclude that the original decision to overthrow Saddam was incorrect. His regime was a threat to the interests of the United States. It was determined by large majorities of both houses of Congress in the 1990s. That the policy of the United States should be regime change in Baghdad. And I think that was the right course. What should we have done differently? I think largely in hindsight, but some certainly advocated at the time, that we should have turned authority back over to Iraqis much more quickly than we did to encourage them to develop their own political culture. You don't enhance political maturation by making decisions for people. And I think that by, in effect, occupying the country, we put ourselves in a disadvantageous position for all the various confessional and ethnic factions in Iraq. And that's one of the reasons the conflict is as it is now. But there are a lot of conflicts in Iraq that are taking place that have absolutely nothing to do with the United States. We didn't cause them. We didn't start the conflict between Sunnis and Shias. We didn't start it, and we can't end it. So that is something that the Iraqis were always going to have to work out on their own anyway. And I think it's important to concentrate on what America's strategic interests were, and those were at the time getting rid of a regime that posed a threat to us because of its policies and its actions in the region, demonstrated historically. And today, by focusing on making sure that no part of Iraq becomes a base for terrorism, what happens to the Iraqis, what form of government they have, I think is largely up to them. I wish them well, but that's not a question of America's strategic interest.
Where are you as a person looking from afar on the debate currently going on in Congress related to changing strategy and or pulling out of Iraq?
Well, I think the principal message of the surge strategy to everybody in Iraq is that that this is the last chance, that Americans are not going to be there in this capacity for very much longer, whether it's 6 months or 9 months is immaterial. We may be in Iraq in some capacity for a longer time, but in terms of what you've seen over the past 4 years of trying to provide security for the Iraqis themselves, it's over. And if the Iraqis want a country that's a peaceful civic society, this is their last chance, too. Now, there are some who don't want that, and they may ultimately prevail. But I think psychologically there is benefit in saying to the Iraqis, this is it. And you need, for example, to pass this bill allocating oil revenues. If they can do that, then I think there's a chance that you could reduce this intercommunal tension. But if they can't do that or they can't agree on an equitable formula, we're certainly not going to do it for them. And that'll be the consequence. But I think one of the most important things is that whatever the circumstances are in the next year or so, that we not be perceived as withdrawing precipitously, that not be perceived to be another Vietnam. Because if it is, the other governments in the region, who are very practical people, will cut deals with Iran. They won't like it, but they'll do it so they can stay in power. And if you don't like $70 a barrel oil now, just wait for the consequence of a perceived rout of the United States from the region.
Well, some in our audience wonder about the current threats of terrorism, and as one person wrote, it seems we have a threat when the president is in trouble. Can you address that?
I think that's ridiculous. Look, what was it? Was it a threat? Was it politically motivated when the World Trade Center fell? Do you think that people are making up the indictments that they've just handed out to people who were threatening JFK Airport in New York, who were threatening Fort Dix in New Jersey, who threatened the Sears Tower in Chicago, who just conducted these attempted attacks in Glasgow and London? Where do you think this is coming from? And we'll see if I suspect that the views of a lot of you in here today favor an administration of a different party in November of next year, and the electorate will tell us what the answer is. And you tell me if in 2009 the threats have gone away.
So you opened the door. Who are you supporting for president in 2008?
I'm not supporting any candidate at this point. I just left the government. I've been in for a long time. I need to repair the family finances, among other things. I'll worry about the presidency a little bit later.
Obviously,
I'm not running for it anyway, so that's...
obviously, the United Nations, coming back full loop, got its start here in San Francisco, and there are folks who believe it's still good for the citizenry to be members of the United Nations Association and carry on its good works. Do you agree with that?
Join whatever organization you like, but don't make the mistake of saying the UN is beneficial when it can't deliver.
And should the...
let me just add another piece to that. I don't think Americans' present low attitude about the UN is ideologically motivated. I think Americans are intensely practical, and I think their approach to the solution of international affairs is, can this organization help us? And if it can't, can it be fixed? And if it can't, what else is available? That's their logic.
One final question. Should the UN move from New York to elsewhere?
No, for whatever else we have to put up with, the economic benefits are worth it.
Our thanks to John Bolton, former United States Ambassador
much.
To the United Nations. Our thanks to John Bolton, former United States Ambassador to the United Nations and senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, for his comments today. We also want to thank our audience here and on the radio. Today's program has been part of the Tobey Family American Values series. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.